I got a letter from Sue Burke, who some of you know. She was at the summer retreat. And she wrote something that was quite interesting, especially some reflections on when I was teaching from Shanti Deva's text, Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So she wrote, my goal for this past Lam Rim Chenrezig retreat was to establish a daily practice and chisel away at my tendency to procrastinate. While I'm happy to say that I have practiced and done exercises every day since the retreat, the way you describe being on a precipice and engaging in behavior because of negative mental imprints and habits, and continuing with these bad habits, would eventually lead to loss of ability and opportunity. All that really woke me up. It is frightening to realize the consequences of this. I overheard some people in the retreat tell you that they thought the message was too strong. Well, for me, the message was just right, and I'm glad you said it just the way you did, because if it had been any softer, I might have missed it. Thanks, it's so much easier now not to have to try and psychoanalyze why I put something off, since I actually enjoy it. Now I just smile and say to myself, oh, this is just negative mental imprinting, and roll up my sleeves and just do it. Now there is a sense of precious urgency with each moment. Yeah. So I thought that was quite interesting. Anybody have comments or reflections? Shanti Deva was definitely relentless. There's no doubt about it. But I thought it was interesting. She said that if the message had been any softer, she wouldn't have gotten it. So I think, you know, that's precisely one of the reasons why it's relentless. Okay, so we finished with the six root disturbing attitudes. They're all gone, taken care of. So now we're on to the 20 secondary, the 20 proximate disturbing attitudes. This is on page 5. So these are called secondary or proximate disturbing attitudes because they are extensions or aspects of the root disturbing attitudes, okay? And because they occur in dependence upon the root disturbing attitudes and thus derive from them. The next one? Okay. So they're classified into different subcategories, these 20 secondary ones. And remember, when we're going through all these mental attitudes, that this is not an extensive list. This is just, in other words, all of our mental thoughts and emotions are not included in these. There's many other ones besides this. These were just the ones that we picked out and highlighted. So there's a whole category of the secondary disturbing attitudes derived from anger, then those derived from attachment, those derived from ignorance, and then those derived from all three, I believe, if I can turn the page. Yeah. Oh, then those derived from both attachment and ignorance, and then those derived from all three. Okay, so let's start with the ones derived from anger. Okay, so remember, so these are ones that are aspects or extension of anger and which occur in dependence on anger. And they all function to make the mind disturbed. And so it disturbs our own happiness, and they motivate us to do actions that disturb the happiness of other living beings. So the first one here is wrath, but I think almost a better translation would be rage. Okay? And so the definition of rage or wrath, whatever you want to call it, is a mental factor that due to an increase of anger is a thoroughly malicious state of mind wishing to cause immediate harm. Okay? So this is the one, you know, when we really lose it. Yeah, if you ever really lost it, this is the one. When we really lose it, this is it. Okay, so it functions to directly connect the person intending to cause harm with the actual means of causing the harm and the object that they're going to cause the harm to. Okay, so this is the one. You can see it starts with the anger. When we don't deal with the anger, then the anger builds, the anger increases, we really lose it, and there's this immediate, very strong wish to cause harm, and then we act on it, thus creating the karma that leaves the imprint on the mind that causes the suffering. So it's classified, there's various ways of classifying rage, the same classifications as we used for anger. So it could be, you know, somebody harmed me, somebody harmed my friend, or somebody helped my enemy. And those three divided into in the past, in the present, and the future. Okay, so the anger is an impatience and an intent to cause harm, which arises when we face somebody else who is disturbing us, or sometimes when we get angry at the suffering, or sometimes we get angry at the instruments or the means that are used to cause us suffering. And so this rage or wrath is an extremely disturbed state of mind that is an increase of this that actually, you know, gets us to go and, you know, go towards the person and strike them or pick up the stick and beat the dog or, you know, cause verbal harm when we really lose it, okay? So this is... with anger, the object that we intend, to, you know, that we're angry at, isn't necessarily in the immediate vicinity, you know. But when rage is there, you know, we make sure if we're not in the immediate vicinity, then we get there very soon, okay? Because this is the one that really motivates us, you know, to connect us and the means of causing harm with the person or, you know, being we want to cause harm to. Right. Well, this is the malice of forethought. Yeah, this mental factor is the malice of forethought. Okay? And so, I mean, of course, sometimes a forethought could be, you know, 10 seconds, okay, or 1 minute. It's not necessarily that we've, you know, meditated on this for 10 years. Yeah, but it's definitely the very strong urge to cause immediate and direct harm. Okay, so this is one we have to really be careful of, I think, for quite obvious reasons. You know, not only the damage that we cause to the people around us, but to remember every time we do that, how much negative karmic imprint we're leaving in our own mind, which influences what we experience later on. So that harming others, harming ourselves, all boils down to the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a distinction between disturbing to us?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between negative mental karma?
Yeah. The negative mental karma, the negative mental actions, like in the 10 disturbing actions, the three that are pointed out there, the coveting, maliciousness, and wrong views, the mental actions or mental karmas are when we really elaborate and we plan on something. We think about something over a period of time, okay? So whereas these ones, the disturbing attitudes, they're kind of the thought behind doing that mental action. Yeah, so like they're like the motivating force that enables us to stay stuck, you know, completely single-pointed on, you know, planning our revenge. Okay, so this whole mental action of planning the revenge is the negative karma. And it's motivated by, like, one of these. But there could be several different mental factors coming in during that whole space of that one negative mental action. Okay? And similarly, sometimes we might have just a negative emotion like this, and it just kind of blips through the mind. You know how we get all these crazy, weird thoughts from time to time? You don't. I'll give you some. I'll pick them out of here. So these things, you know, they leave some kind of imprint on our mind, but they're not kind of the complete mental action because we haven't really gotten into it in the planning and thinking about the whole thing. Okay. Because sometimes, like, we might just have some strange thought go through our mind, you know, like one of these disturbing attitudes, and it just blips through, and it's there, and it's gone. And it makes some kind of imprint, but it's not a total, you know, mental action. Because a total mental action, it's like we have that, you know, that thought, and then we sit, and we develop it, and we plan it out, and we really get into it. Okay. Right. Well, it's a disturbing attitude. Okay. That, you know, of course reinforces the habit of having it. But, you know, it's when we actually do the whole action of, you know, mentally thinking about this for a period of time that the karma gets involved. And also the karma is created because we have, like I said, several different disturbing attitudes going on. You know, because when you're plotting on how you want to tell somebody off, you know, you have a variety of different things going on. Sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's jealousy, then you go into pride when you think of how well you're going to do it. Yeah, all these things. The opposite of this one? Positive attitudes. You know, when we went through the 11 virtuous mental factors, many of those are the antidotes and the opposites of these ones here. Well, I think you need to be more specific about the situation and what you were thinking at each point of it.
It's like some person dressed in rags walking to the airport really with the pants falling down, and my first thought was like, why do they let these people come in here kind of thing? And I was eating, and then the thought came, I gotta give them some of my food, but first I gotta finish. And then my third thought is, why do I have to finish before I eat the rest? And I got up and I gave him my bagel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back and I thought it happened so fast.
Uh-huh.
And the reaction that he had was so positive.
Uh-huh.
You know, because he was looking through the garbage, you know, cans. And I was surprised at myself because the practice was really scared of the sky.
Uh-huh.
I was surprised that when he was the person who actually wanted to give me a bagel. Mm-hmm. So it was a negative thought.
But
no,
that negative thought didn't produce the positive action because you were able to identify that as a negative thought. And then you had the thought, why don't I be kind to this guy? And he's probably hungry, and why don't I give him something? So it was that positive thought that motivated your action, not the negative one.
I was more aware of the negative.
Yeah, you were.
That I was feeling that
right. Right. You were more aware of that. But, you know, in the way you described it, you did have that thought about, you know, some kind of thought of kindness. And you used that to apply it, you know, in your mind. The way it worked was that was an antidote to those feelings of disgust and fear. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's actually what we want to do is train ourselves so that impulse, that positive impulse, can like come very quickly. Yeah. And train ourselves so that we don't just get stuck in the negative one and develop it. But maybe it's time to get away of the positive ones too. Imagine that. Okay. So clearly with this one of rage, you know, we need to be quite careful. Already before, you know, when I talked about anger and the antidotes to anger, then I explained, you know, how to work with this whole thing. And so it's incredibly important to be able to identify the anger when it's small before the anger gets big and it grows into rage. Because once it grows into rage, we know for ourselves, you know, with the adrenaline pumping, at that point it becomes very, very difficult to control ourselves. You know, because you not only have the mind going, but you have the body going. Okay? So it's real important to try and catch the anger when it's small, apply the antidote at that point. And even if we can't, even if the whole thing happens so fast, and we're like in a full-blown rage, at least at that point to be able to identify it and get ourselves out of the situation so that we don't actually harm somebody. It was quite interesting when I was on the Chapman retreat last week, there was one young man who, it was only at the end of the retreat, he told me about a little bit about his family background, and it was quite unpleasant with an alcoholic father who beat his mother and beat the kids, and he saw within himself, you know, sometimes that he would really lose his temper, you know, have this mental factor of rage, that he had that same kind of potential. He'd kind of seen it in action in his family, and you know how kids learn by, we watch our parents, don't we? So sometimes we just copy, and then, you know, that mental factor just gets free rein. So he saw that, you know, that possibility for that mental factor was existing in him, and he felt it sometimes. But he had such a very, very strong determination after seeing the effects of his father's actions, that he just had this very strong mind that he would never, ever, ever be like that in his family. So that force of that really strong determination. You know, when we do the four opponent powers, you know, the determination not to repeat it. So by the force of that one, he found whenever he got angry, you know, like before he lost it, he would just, you know, especially with his family, he would excuse himself from the situation, and he would just say to his wife, you know, look, I'm really mad and I got to go cool off. And he'd go outside, he'd walk around the block, or he, you know, do something, and then he'd come back in and he'd talk about it. Yeah. And so I think, you know, by being aware of that potential within himself and having that strong determination, you know, not to act it out, and then he had some ways of dealing with it when it arose. So I think that was quite good what he did. And so also, you know, regarding that one of rage, I think sometimes it's very helpful for us to do lots of purification practice for the times when we really have lost our temper and really have lost it. Because that force of that, of the regret and the determination not to do it again, you know, is very, very powerful, and that helps us to not do it again and to become more aware of it. And I think equally important is to be able to forgive ourselves for the times when we have lost it. Because very often what happens is we really, you know, we just fly into a rage, we do and say incredible things, and then afterwards we feel so incredibly guilty that we sit and beat up on ourselves for months and years. And that becomes a very negative thing that actually impedes us from growing when we feel guilty about it. Okay, so this is why purification is very involved with forgiving ourselves, which is very involved with rechanneling the energy. You're chipping away at the disturbing attitudes in the sense that you're becoming much more aware of what they are, and you're knowing that that action is motivated by this disturbing attitude, so you're making a resolve to try and not to have that one, and if you have it, then to at least become aware of it. Okay? So what you're doing is you're kind of lessening the habit of having that one. If you make really strong intentions and do a lot of purification. And that's nice to know we can do that, isn't it? The visualization the same way. For example, if you're doing it with the Vajrasattva, and this is why I think the visualization is so really great, when you like when you do the one and you imagine the nectar coming in, that light and nectar from the top flushing you out, and then all this tar and gook and, you know, pollution coming out your lower orifices, it, you know, it's quite graphic. And you can think, you know, not only is this all the, you know, the imprints from the actions I've done, but this is the whole, you know, you can think this is the disturbing attitude that is there that could cause me to do it again. Okay, so all my, you know, rage, my hostility, my resentment, whatever it is, you imagine that also being washed out of you too. Okay? And that actually functions to give us a lot more confidence that we don't need to fall prey to those disturbing attitudes, you know, and that they aren't an inherent part of us. And it acts to help us to forgive ourselves for having them. Yeah. So, I mean, in this whole purification thing, if there's things that, you know, that we don't like about ourselves for one reason or another, like, you know, these kinds of attitudes, then you just do the visualization. You imagine them flowing out of you in the form of these really disgusting things. Okay. And then similarly, when you're getting filled up with the light, then you feel that let's say the love and kindness or the compassion or the patience or whatever it is you need to develop, that is appearing in the nature of the light and nectar, and that's filling you up. So you kind of use it to transform your mind into those positive mental states. Okay, ready for the next one? Next one is vengeance. Okay, commonly known as grudge holding. So it's a mental factor that, without forgiving, firmly holds on to the fact that in the past one was harmed by a particular person and wishes to retaliate. Next one. Okay, this one specifically is talking about it being a holding on of the anger or holding on of the hatred and a wish to retaliate. I think also closely allied with this one is resentment. Okay, and I was thinking about it this afternoon. Could this one also be called resentment? And I don't know, in English, when we think of resentment, do we necessarily think of retaliating? Or, because I was thinking about it. First, when I thought about resentment, I thought, well, I could really resent the fact that somebody did something and not really wish to retaliate. But when I looked a little bit deeper at the resentment, there was often a wish that something bad would happen to the other person. You know, kind of like, you know, not necessarily that I would retaliate, but that they would get it from somebody or somehow, you know. Okay. What do you think? What does the word resentment mean to you?
Wishing that person to forgive, to ask me to forgive them for what they did to me, but not necessarily anything bad happened to them. It's more like I wish that they see what they did or they understood what they did.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that also that's the prominent thing in resentment. There's a big focus on me,
yeah.
But that also leads to kind of, wouldn't it be nice if they got their due? I don't know, it's just something to check up in our mind.
They're also intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't think of resentment quite as you were saying about which was the vengeance, but it might be the immediately preceding or following thought.
Yeah, that you start out with resentment and it grows into vengeance.
No, all these, I mean, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
You know. A worm's nest or some expression like that.
Beehive.
Beehive.
Yeah. We get stung. So it's just interesting maybe to think about here a little bit as we talk about this one, you know, what we think of as resentment, and if the resentment grows into the vengeance, or if at the resentment there is that thought. I mean, it's just something to explore in our meditation as we look at our own mind. And it's kind of hard to admit this one of either resentment or of vengeance, you know, even if they are two different things. Because usually what's happening when we have those manifest in the mind is we're so focused on it being the other person's fault and we're the victim. Yeah? And so I was thinking about that this is the one that a lot of times when people are in therapy, this is one of the big ones that is stuck in the mind because there's a lot of grudge holding from things that were done to us in the past. Just something that happened whenever, how many ever decades ago, then, you know, we hold on to it. Our memory won't let it go. You know, we cling on, and there's anger, or there's hatred, or there's a wish to retaliate in there. And even if there isn't the wish to retaliate, there's still the resentment, the anger, the hatred, okay? So it's a real holding on to something that goes long over a period of time. And this one is actually quite pernicious, because like I said, first of all, we don't think that it's a disturbing attitude. We think we're right, we're justified, that this other person really is a jerk and they did harm us and we want to blame them. You bet. And if somebody suggests the opposite, then we think that we're being completely... that nobody's hearing our story, yeah? Which is not the case at all, because we could have been harmed very, very much, but that doesn't mandate that we carry a grudge for years. And see, sometimes what happens is we feel the only response we could have to such kind of harm we receive is the only thing we can possibly do is to hold on to this grudge. But actually, we have a choice in the matter. Because when we hold on to a grudge, who is it that suffers? Now, hold on. Okay? You can hold your grudge. Because when we hold on to our grudge, I mean, the other person, maybe they died, maybe they're having a hot fudge sundae, you know? I mean, they've gotten on with their lives. But we sit there... Yeah. You know. But we've gotten totally stuck there in thinking about the harm that they did us before. Yeah, you know. That's what it is. You know, if I can't do it, karma's going to get him. And so we just hold on to this very, very negative feeling. And we actually torture ourselves a lot with it. Because every time we remember the awful things somebody did to us, you know, they only did it to us once. We think about it every day and we do it to ourselves every time we think about it. Okay? So we, you know, every time we think about it with this hatred, we imprint, you know, that attitude deeper and deeper in our own mind. And it causes so much internal suffering to ourselves in the present moment, as well as puts all this imprint in our mind that causes future suffering. And this one is, I mean, this is the one that's going on in former Yugoslavia. This is the mental factor motivating that whole war, you know, so that people who were, you know, who weren't even alive when harm was done in the past are now harming strangers that they don't know. Who also weren't alive when the harm was done in the past. Because of this vengeance getting passed down from generation to generation. You know, parents teaching their kids how to hate. Parents teaching their kids that they should get evil and they should retaliate. And so it's really sinister. I mean, you see this all throughout, you know, so many ethnic conflicts and various conflicts. And you see it in families. You know, I think some of you heard the stories about my family. Some of you heard it. I tell it again for the others again. Okay, well. when I was a little kid, because my extended family is in the Chicago area, and they have a summer house in Wisconsin. So we used to go to the summer house just from time to time because we lived so far away. And there were two big houses, and each one had an upstairs and a downstairs. And I was instructed that we were never supposed to talk to one family who lived in one of the houses. I was a kid. Well, why? You know, well, just don't talk to them. Why? You know, well, it wound up that somehow my grandmother was related to their brother, you know, their father or grandfather was my grandmother's brother or sister or somebody, you know, and they had something happen between them, which nobody remembered. They couldn't even tell me what happened. But the conclusion was that I wasn't supposed to talk to those people. Yeah. So I said, okay, well, that's grandparents' generation, you know, they just do that, you know. Then, a few years later, a few years down the line, when I became, you know, in my early 20s, then what started happening is my mother's, this is on my mother's side of the family, that her brothers and sisters, not all of them, kept speaking to each other, you know, because this one didn't like what this one did, because the son worked for the business, and blah, 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 blah. So then, within that generation, you know, not all the brothers and sisters speak to each other. So I thought, well, that's grown-ups for you. now that I'm a little bit older, amongst my generations and the cousins, not all the cousins speak to each other. So generation after generation, all these people who go to the same family, the same house for summer vacation to have a good time, you know, at any one time in all the four apartments, not all of the people speak to each other. And they're all there to enjoy themselves for summer holiday. Okay? And my cousins now have kids, so I'm wondering what's going to happen with them. So all this makes it very, very, you know, difficult. I remember in my family, whenever there was a wedding, to make the seating list for where everybody was going to sit. It was so difficult because this one didn't talk to this one, but that one talked to this one, but didn't talk to this one. You know? And you just know that these people you aren't supposed to like and you aren't supposed to talk to. And you can't even remember why. Yeah. But we carry on this kind of attitude. I mean, this is a really gross example. But we carry this on in our own mind, causing so much pain. And this is what we teach to our kids to do. So it is very, very sinister, this mental fracking. And it's also excruciatingly painful, you know, because when we hold on to that grudge, our mind is, you know, not in peace. So again, you know, sometimes it's quite a difficult mental factor to work with because we're so convinced that we're right. We're so fearful that if we give up, the grudge that will be mowed down again in the future. So we often use the anger as a way to defend against future harm, but the anger actually, you know, in another way creates more harm. Okay? So it's quite difficult. So it's really helpful, you know, in our meditation to sometimes pull these things out, you know, these grudges that we have. And we may think we don't have any grudges, but then you know how you're sitting and meditating and all of a sudden you get mad at somebody for something they did last year? Yeah? Well, that's this mental factor, you know, here we are, holding on and, you know, especially if there's the wish to retaliate. We're still mad at that person. We haven't given up the anger. You know, we're still looking to get even. And so here, it's very useful to really work very deeply with the meditations on patience. Yeah, like in the back of what color is your mind? And you know, in Shantideva, you know, Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way, Chapter 6. To really work very, very deeply with those and pull out some of those grudges from the past and really relive them and rethink them, but thinking in the way that the Buddha has described. And in that way, we can start to work through some of these grudges, and what it does is it gets rid of our whole psychological burden. Because it's really a tragedy, isn't it? You know, we've all seen people who wind up to be very old and they're just really bitter, you know, quite bitter people. And it's so sad because that's what's happened, you know. They just held on to their hatred year after year. Yeah. So it's important that we don't become bitter like that and carry around these kinds of psychological burdens, because we're the ones that suffer the most from it. Okay, so having some kind of courageous mind to pull these things out in our meditation and really start to, you know, use the meditations on patience and apply them. And also in the Chapman retreat, it was real interesting because this same young man that I was referring to before, he was telling me, you know, because of these incredible things that happened when he was a kid. I mean, he wound up in a correction facility at age 14 for stealing cars. Okay? So, I mean, it was pretty heavy what was going on in his background. And he told me that when he was meditating, that he would remember all sorts of situations from the past, you know, and things that he didn't want to remember and he didn't want to think about anymore. And they just kept come up because, I mean, that's what happens when you meditate. But he said that when they would come up, he would just take one at a time and he would just sit there and look at it again and think, you know, how else can I look at this now? You know, if I were with my present knowledge and maturity to go back in that situation, even if it was a situation when he was, you know, 6 years old or whatever, how would I act? How could I look at it? How could I think? What are other ways to deal with it? And so he said whenever these, you know, memories came up, this is what he started to do. And that's really a way to kind of work through a lot of that stuff and not carry it around, you know, the bitterness, the vengeance, and things like that. So, you know, it sometimes involves taking a lot of time and bringing these things up and really thinking, well, how else could I look at it? You know, or what really was going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now I have to ask this, that really hard to do what you're saying. I don't mean just hard like that, make it hard. It's really that sometimes the things that come up, we might not even be ready to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I was in the heat, like I thought I was going to go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I had to hold on to the mantra and can't barely make it because I thought I was going to become insane before the coming up with something that I felt like I needed somebody else to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we deal with resentment, especially with resentment of our parents or something like that, stuff like that can come out. That it's really hard, like, that we don't have the clarity to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, we can just push it down and deal with it a little bit at a time or something.
Mm-hmm.
And try to help something. I know I just find it very hard.
Right.
And, like, right now, when you were talking about it, and I know that because of my parents, a lot of parents are very always constantly thinking sometimes. I don't know whether you would call it resentment, but instead of wishing that something bad happened to them, I know that a lot of people wish they would stop thinking and then they would see me. You know what I mean? But it's still, I don't know whether that's still with resentment.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether that's, you know, that's why resentment and holding a grudge get really stuck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I'm looking at my needs, not at them. Yet I don't want, because they're your parents, they never really wish something bad to happen.
Right, but you do wish that they stop what they were doing. And that's why I was saying that these could be, you know, similar you know, resentment and grudge holding could be similar but not exactly the same mental factor. That's why I was saying, you know, why I was throwing out the question at the beginning, could we translate that this as resentment, or is resentment actually a little bit different? Or is there a way in which...
Because either there is a wish of something bad happening,
well, it also, it depends, like if you wish somebody to start drinking, it depends also on the texture of your mind when you wish them. Because if you really wish them well, you could say it with a lot of love, but I wish they'd stop drinking. Or you could say it with a lot of, again, resentment and craving for attention and self-centered attitude. So it isn't just the wish, it's what's motivating the wish that we have to look at. And as to the thing that you said before, that sometimes these things come up in retreat and they're pretty heavy, that's why it's very, you know, it's usually advised when you do a long retreat to have other Dharma friends or one of your teachers nearby, so that if things come up and you feel that they're a little bit beyond what you're prepared to deal with, then you have some help and people who can, you know, help you do this. And then slowly, gradually, you know, your own mind becomes stronger. We slowly learn to become a doctor to our own mind. At the beginning, we may not do, you know, this kind of huge thing comes up and we treat and we feel totally lost. But, you know, over a period of time of learning to deal with it and work with it, we begin to get some tools and to have a handle on it and have some confidence in that. Okay, but that's why it's good when this stuff comes up and, you know, when we feel like, whoa, then to go and, you know, talk to a Dharma friend or talk to your teacher. So, one of my teachers was saying about this that, well, or Nagarjuna actually said it, that we should try and make the imprints of our positive thoughts like engraving on stone, and the imprints of our negative thoughts like writing on water. Yeah. So instead of vice versa, and making the negative thought like engraving on stone, which is what this grudge holding is, it's engraving the negative thought on stone. We should make our positive thoughts like stone etching. Okay, and so it's especially important, you know, as practitioners that we try and really look at any grudges that we're carrying around, because this is something that really poisons our practice quite a bit. You know, because if we're trying to meditate and develop even equanimity, let alone love and compassion, even equanimity, you know, it's going to be very difficult to develop if this mental factor is very strong in our mind, if we're holding on to a lot of stuff. So it's quite important for us to acknowledge what the grudges are, and again, not to feel guilty because of having them, not to hate ourselves from having them, not to just simply tell ourselves, I shouldn't be mad at that person anymore, because telling ourselves what we should feel does not do anything, okay? But to really, you know, take these things out and apply the antidotes and work with it. And be very patient with ourselves in the process of doing it. Because I've really seen, you know, over the years, that things that like came up, you know, like whomp, when at the beginning, you know, they were just really overwhelming, and you try and practice this antidote and you're like, you know, drowning. But slowly over the years, as you start to practice the antidote, that gets stronger and you begin to not take these kinds of mental events quite so seriously. You know, so they might still come up, and each time they come up, you look at it, you apply the antidote, you peel off a few more layers from the onion, okay, you wash the dirty cloth a little bit more, and you know it's not perfectly clean, you know your mind isn't totally at peace with this issue, you know it's going to take some more work, but, you know, you worked on it as best you can for right now, and then it goes in the back burner, and it kind of stays cool for a while, and then something else happens, you know, a few months, a couple of years down the line, and, you know, it explodes again, but you have more you know, the habit and ability to deal with it this time. And then we just keep working on it and chipping away at it. Yeah. Right. Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, they do. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it is helpful, I think, to have several different translations here, because then we can look at what these different English words mean to us. And some of these English words, you know, fit the general definition here, but also they have slightly different flavors to them. Okay. Which one's five? Two, three, four. Jealousy. Harmful. Oh, should I put them in a different order here?
This is number five.
Yeah. Well, these things are all very, very interrelated, aren't they? Actually, it's quite interesting because I prepared for different ones. They're a different order here. Well, okay, I'll skip number three on my list. We'll go to number three on your list. Okay? No. Yeah, spite. Yeah, okay, so spite. A mental factor which preceded by wrath or vengeance and as an outcome of malice motivates one to utter harsh words in reply to unpleasant words said by others. Okay, so, yeah, right, so, you know, it just says the spite here. Yeah, but we can see, I mean, because again, like what you were saying before, Marcia, you know, we might think, oh, well, spite, I'm not a very spiteful person, you know, because spite is just something, you know, that these horrible people do when they nitpick or something. But when we look at the definition, okay, you know, the wish to utter harsh words that really, you know, get to somebody. Well, unfortunately, you know, we have to admit that that one's there. Quite big sometimes, isn't it? Okay, so this is this one functions very much to it enables us to accumulate vast quantities of negative karma quickly, perfectly. It also very clearly disturbs the happiness of ourself and others, because you know when this kind of wish to speak harshly to others comes in our mind. Our own mind is turbulent. We spend a lot of time plotting exactly what words we're going to say. Now, or sometimes, sometimes we even write it down, don't we? Or sometimes, if we have this one really strong with an urgency, you know, we just pick up the phone or it comes right out of our mouth right there in the present. We don't even spend time mulling it over. You know, into mind, out of mouth. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You know, and then what you get in as a result is what's the latest equivalent of, you know, Peyton Place and L.A. Law and all these things rolled into each other. I mean, you watch TV. You know. What? Yeah, well, not just soap operas, but most of the you know, a lot of the series, Dallas and all this kind of stuff. If you look at the characters in these kinds of things, right, is the harsh words, yeah? And so, you know, this mental factor is really, really prominent in all those different TV characters. And, you know, we see them acting it out, saying lots of harsh words to each other. And then every once in a while, this previous one of rage comes up, and then they throw something. So this actually is, you know, one reason why we have to be very careful on how we relate to the media, because we watch this stuff. So it, again, imprints the actions in our mind, and it makes us tap into those same mental factors within ourselves. Yes? And sometimes it's actually very helpful to act these things out. We did this one time when I lived in the monastery in France. We did a Dharma drama, and it was very good. We got together as a group, and I think one person kind of had the basic idea, and then different people added in things. And it was a story about one person. And they had, you know, and then various other people became, you know, the anger, the ignorance, the attachment, the jealousy, and the pride. And so we had costumes for each of these mental factors and how they would come up, and they would do their dance and do their story and, you know, torment this person. And so then this person went to get some Dharma teachings.
Yeah.
You want to know who I played?
No, your nemesis played.
He wasn't around at that time. Where was I? Oh, yeah, so we had the character, you know, and then these five negative thoughts, each doing their trip, and this person went to get Dharma teachings, and then how they learned to work with each of these thoughts, which then got transformed into the five wisdoms and placed in the mandala. Yeah? And it was very nice to act this out, because, you know, when you look at all of these different ones and you think, well, how would I act this out if I were doing drama, you know, or doing dance? It really helps you get in touch with how these things feel in our body, because these things do set off triggers in our body. And so that helps us learn to recognize them. And we also get more of a feeling of the mental texture of the mind when these things are manifest. We get a feeling for what the antidotes to them could be. Yeah. So it's often... Finally, you asked. I was the nun. Well, because spite, again, if we look at it as an attitude, not necessarily as the action, it's the attitude that motivates the action. Again, the antidote here would be patience, the ability to be, you know, calm and tranquil in the confront of harm, instead of having this urge to speak harshly arise when we're confronted with harm. Yeah. Well, the first thing would be to keep our mouth closed. Okay? So that's if we're talking about the action, the negative action of harsh speech, mm-hmm. which is motivated by this spite. Okay, but now we're talking about the karma, the negative action of harsh speech. Or the first thing to do would be not to say that. And the not saying of it is already a positive action. Okay, so we can already pat ourselves on the back by just keeping our mouth closed. Okay, then on top of that, if we can actually process the whole thing, understand the other person's suffering, think of a way to communicate with them effectively, and then take some steps to do that, then that's quite a positive action there. Because they were actually initiating something out of compassion to help the other person. So, you know, again, this one of spite is the wish to utter harsh words. It comes so often in our life, doesn't it? You know, this one just comes up like a flash, and there we are, you know, saying who knows what afterwards, and then really feeling regretful later. And also, you know, because of the harsh words that are motivated by this spite, we destroy a lot of trust in relationships. Yeah? So that, you know, all of these things, especially like the rage and the spite, you know, which often, you know, sometimes those are things that we really, you know, build up over time and plan how to harm the other person. But sometimes they could just come up in a flash and we say incredible things or do incredible things. And then, you know, years of time that we spent building up trust with somebody, that trust really gets shattered. So it's, you know, very, very important to be on the outlook, you know, the lookout for this kind of mental factor. Because it really does so much harm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No. The different people portrayed.
Or the different people portrayed.
Yeah.
So what bike were they? I mean, because
yeah. Right. But often when you talk about like the five Dhyani Buddhas, and then it's related to five wisdoms, there they pick out the three poisonous attitudes, which are three of the six. And then they add to that pride, which is also one of the six, and jealousy, which is coming up. Okay. Also sometimes instead of pride, they say miserliness. Okay, so sometimes they have pride, sometimes miserliness. Okay, so the antidote for anger is the wisdom of the Dharma Dhatu, the wisdom that sees the sphere of phenomena, the wisdom of knowing emptiness. All these wisdoms have the same nature, but it's just pointing out different aspects of them. Okay, and then for ignorance, it's the mirror-like wisdom, okay, that's able just to reflect the qualities. For the pride or the pride or the miserliness, because sometimes they have one, sometimes the other. Then it's the wisdom of equality. And for the attachment, then it's the wisdom of discriminating wisdom. And then for jealousy, it's the all-accomplishing wisdom. And so there's parallels between these wisdoms and the five, and then they have, you know, they correlate it with the five Dhyani Buddhas and, you know, all these different things. But it's quite interesting to think about, and especially to reflect on and see, you know, how a specific take on wisdom can be used to help us counteract different disturbing attitudes. Okay, this one with spite, it's classified. I love when they classify these things, okay? It's classified into the intention, it's into three, you know, the intention to say harsh, angry words to someone who is one, equal to ourself, two, inferior to us, and three, superior to us. Okay? So it's, you know, sometimes when you have a fight with your partner, you know, we say spite, we have the intention to say harmful words to somebody who's equal to us. When we do it to our kids, to somebody who's inferior to us, when we do it to like our boss and somebody in that situation, you know, or if we do it who's superior to us, or if we do it to somebody who has a lot of very good qualities, you know, somebody who's further along than us on the part on the path, then that's harsh words to somebody who's superior to us. So it might be interesting also to kind of look at in our own experience and see who we tend to dump on the most. Yeah? Do we dump on the dog? Do we dump on our partner? Or do we dump on our boss? Yeah? No, but it's interesting to see. I'm using very gross examples here, but it's interesting just to get a flavor. It just gives us some more information about ourselves and how we handle our emotions, and then to get an idea of who we need to be especially aware about, you know, and not just thinking that because it's the dog, we can dump on the dog. You know, the dog has feelings too. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, sometimes we say pretty nasty things to ourselves too. Something else I wanted to say about this one that I forgot, which is the mental factor of forgetfulness is coming up. That's a derivative of ignorance. There are plenty of. Okay, oh, also to be aware that the spite can come out as ridicule, it can come out as teasing, it can be said in a very, you know, it can come out in words that seem sweet and innocent. Okay, so harsh words don't necessarily have to be said in a nasty tone of voice. They can be said in a very sweet tone of voice. But and often that way they damage even more sometimes. Then the next one, jealousy. Okay. So jealousy, a distinct mental factor that out of attachment to respect or material gain is unable to bear the good things others have. Okay? So we're attached to material things, we're attached to respect, we're attached to reputation, we're attached to image, we're attached to praise, whatever it is, we're attached to a particular person. We're attached to being loved. We're attached to who knows what. But somebody else has it instead of us. And we can't bear the fact that they're happy and we aren't. Okay? So this is the exact opposite of wishing others well. You know, it's like others have something good. We didn't even have to do anything to make them happy. And yet we can't endure it. We're all the time saying, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. You know? And then finally, somebody has happiness in its causes, and we didn't even provide it or have to lift a finger. And all of a sudden, we can't stand it. You know, may this person not have happiness in its causes. You know? And you know, we really wish them ill. So, this... jealousy, it functions as the basis for immediate mental unhappiness and turmoil. Because it's true, isn't it? When we're jealous of somebody, we are miserable. Totally miserable. It also functions to cause our own good things to be exhausted. You know, because when we have a jealous personality, then you know, often the very things that we're attached to, that we're craving to have more of for ourselves, that we don't want others to have because of our jealousy, we lose ourselves, don't we? Okay? And also it causes our good karma to be exhausted. So, you know, not only on a practical level does it cause our good fortune to be exhausted, but also karmically it does. And it often, jealousy often contains a certain element of fear because we're afraid somebody else will get something that we want. Or we're afraid somebody else will be better than we are. So, you know, fear comes up. It's interesting. Fear is not listed as a distinct mental factor in these 51, but you can see how it plays a role in many of the others. You know, often when there's attachment, there's fear involved. So here, too, with jealousy, there's very often fear involved because we're afraid somebody's going to get it. We're afraid they're going to have the happiness, and we aren't. Okay? So sometimes it's for others' possessions. Sometimes it's for we're jealous of people. Sometimes we're jealous of other people's qualities. You know, they're better than us in something. We're jealous of their reputation, whatever it is. But it's very definitely poison to our own mind. And jealousy, too, really destroys relationships very much because when we're jealous of somebody, sometimes the people that we're jealous of, we look at as enemies, and so we're jealous, and then we have just a really negative attitude. It's like we can't say anything nice about that person. They may have all these good qualities, all these things are going well, but we can't say anything nice. You know, all we want to do, it, you know, the jealousy really motivates us to badmouth them. And so of the 10 negative actions, the one of divisive words or slander, where we separate people and cause disharmony, jealousy is often a prime motivator for that negative karma. So we can't stand somebody else's happiness, so what are we going to do? We're going to use our speech to destroy their happiness in one way or another. Okay, so sometimes it comes out that way. So, you know, that's when we see the person we're jealous of as an enemy. Sometimes we're jealous of our friend. And that's really awful, you know? It's really awful when we're jealous of our friends because a friend, kind of by definition, friends should be people whose good things we rejoice in. You know, it's like when we have friends, we want our friends to really rejoice when something nice happens to us. And we want our friends to feel happy about our good qualities or happy about things that happen. And if a friend, you know, doesn't rejoice in our happiness, then because they're jealous of it, then it really poisons the relationship. So similarly, when we have that kind of jealousy towards our friends, that it really poisons. Because then, you know, the friend is, you know, how can our friend trust us if we don't even wish them well? Yeah, because when we're jealous, you know, at the time the jealousy comes up, at that moment we're not wishing them well. It doesn't mean we're jealous of them all the time and never wish them well. They're a friend, we do wish them well. But sometimes, you know, the jealousy comes up and really poisons it because at those moments we can't stand that they have that happiness or that they're better than us. Mm-hmm. And so in our attempt to really connect with other people, especially the people we have some affinity for and the people we like, you know, this jealousy really destroys those relationships. They're often very important to us. A form of need? Greed. In some ways, it appears, you know, super. To me, when I hear this kind of definition of jealousy, I had the same reaction, like jealous. You know, I usually think of a jealous as I want it for myself, so it's greedy. I want it, I want it. But when I looked at it another way, it's not able to bear that the other person has it and is happy. Because often with jealousy, we act out the jealousy, and as long as the other person isn't happy, we're not even concerned whether we are or not. Just as long as they don't have it. Right, exactly.
If there wasn't something to compare it with, you probably wouldn't be greedy about it. Mm-hmm. There's something that makes it up.
Right. Oh, yeah. So as we compare, we are greedy. We want it for ourselves. But sometimes having it for ourselves isn't even so important. We just don't want the other person to have it. You know, we don't want them to have the promotion. We don't want them to have a good time. We don't want them to have the attention. It's often focused very much on destroying others' happiness. Okay, so what it does, this one causes us sometimes to be, you know, of course, to be born in the hell realm. Sometimes as a snake, a snake is often a symbol of like jealousy. Sometimes it can cause us to be reborn as one of the demigods, the jealous gods. And the jealous gods, it's very interesting because, I mean, there's something quite symbolic in the situation of the jealous gods that we can relate to. In the way they describe the universe, you know, there's Mount Meru and the center of the universe. So the god realms, you know, the god realms live on the top. They live on the top part of Mount Meru and then above Mount Meru. But on the top part of Mount Meru, they have all this fruit and all these beautiful things, and it's really spectacular. But the roots of the trees that bear the fruit on the top of the mountain, the roots are down at the bottom of the mountain, and that's where the jealous gods live, the demigods. Sometimes they're translated as titans. So these gods, even though they have many nice things, you know, they can't stand the fact that the gods have nicer things, you know. And they say, but the roots grew on our territory, and you get the fruit, so you should give the fruit to us. Okay? So they're constantly fighting with the gods. Yeah. Because they can't stand that the gods have more. They want it. Okay? And so what happens, what they often talk about when they describe the demigod realm, and you can see this very clearly, when we are jealous of somebody, we might have a lot of things going well for us. We might have a lot of happiness and a lot of enjoyment, but we can't enjoy any of them. Yeah? So being jealous has nothing to do really with our not having happiness, because we could have lots of stuff going for us, but we can't even enjoy it because we're so burned. We're burning up with jealousy that somebody else has some good fortune. Like these gods, you know, these demigods. And so they're always battling, always fighting, constantly killing, and in the process of doing so, destroying their own happiness. Yeah. Asuras, yeah. And Asuras are the gods that have all the super duper sensual pleasure. But it's quite interesting to think, because the Asuras, these jealous gods, of the six realms of existence, they're considered an upper realm, a higher realm, actually having more pleasure than human beings. But because of their mental state, it becomes very difficult for them to enjoy their pleasure. So I find it very interesting, you know, to observe, you know, our own minds when we get really burnt up with jealousy. We can't enjoy what we do have. There's just this constant discontent and real wish to destroy somebody else's happiness, which leads to us to do who knows what. We probably know what we do when we're jealous. Okay, so often when we compete, okay, competitiveness is kind of similar in the way that they often say that jealousy is when we can't bear somebody else's superior fortune to us, when they have more fortune than us. And competitiveness is when we can't bear their equal fortune. Yeah, so somebody's just as good as us, we can't bear that they're just as good, we want to be better, so we compete. It's interesting to look at competition that way, isn't it? Yeah? As something that is related to jealousy in this way. Because it's true, if that person who's equal to us now does become better, then we get really jealous of them. Yeah, whether it's still equal, then we're just really competitive. So the antidote to this one is rejoicing. Okay, so rejoicing is simply being happy about other people's good qualities, about their wealth, about their happiness. It's just being happy that others are happy. Sorry. So rejoicing is actually a very, very important part of the practice. In the Four Immeasurables, No, when we, it's one of the four immeasurables. When we say, may all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. Okay? There we're rejoicing in their happiness. There we're wishing that they never be separated from happiness. So rejoicing comes up as one of the four immeasurables. In the seven-limb prayer, it also comes up as the fourth limb. You know, rejoicing at others' virtue and good qualities. So it's a very, very important quality, especially for Dharma practitioners, because if it becomes very difficult to practice Dharma if we're competing in our practice with other people, or if we're really jealous of people who are better practitioners than we are, or people who have more good qualities than we are, or people who have more opportunity to practice than we are, or people who are, you know, whatever it is in the Dharma circles that we want, the people who have more or better, and we're jealous of them, it really destroys our practice. So this you know, mental factor comes in our ordinary life, it also comes in our Dharma life, and it's quite destructive in either way. And so the antidote of rejoicing is just saying, somebody else is happy, I'm really glad. No, and most of the time, you know, like I said before, we're always saying, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. So here's somebody with happiness. I didn't even have to do it. Why not rejoice? You know, it's actually fulfilling what I've been praying for and wishing for. Isn't it? Yeah. So here somebody has it. So this is good. Let's rejoice. And so it's actually quite something when we actually sit and let our mind rejoice, our mind becomes very, very happy. When we start really thinking about, you know, oh, you know, you might do a meditation on rejoicing where you go by and you really think of other people's possessions and you just, I'm so happy this person has this, I'm so happy they have that, they must be really happy having that. You know? And then you go back and maybe you think of their achievements and I'm so happy somebody was able to do that. I'm so happy when they were to do. Then maybe you think of their qualities. I'm so happy somebody's able to do this. I'm so happy that they have this talent. Yeah. Or you think of how much other people are loved and appreciated and I'm so happy that they have love. I'm so happy they have close friends and good relationships. And so if we train our mind in this attitude of rejoicing, what happens is it becomes very easy for us to be happy. Now, we don't have to do much to be happy, except look at others and just be happy at their happiness. They also say that rejoicing is the lazy person's way to create a lot of positive potential. Okay, so everybody who's lazy, here's your practice. Because karmically, when we rejoice at somebody like who is further along than us on the path, if we rejoice at their actions, their attitudes, and so on, that we get like half as much good karma. If we rejoice as, you know, but
we get it right.
Half as much good karma as they got, which is still more than we get for ourselves, isn't it? You know, so this is when we rejoice, when we think about the qualities of the Buddhas, when we think about how the Bodhisattvas practice the six far-reaching attitudes and we rejoice, and we think of all of these things, and they say that we get half as much good karma as they get. So you see why it's a lazy person's way to create a lot of good karma? We don't have to even do it, we just, you know, have to feel happy about it. But it's actually something that's quite valuable, you know, because when we think about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas' actions and we feel happy, then our mind gets inspired and feels happy to act the same way. When we rejoice at peers, you know, people who are equal to us, when we rejoice at their happiness and their good qualities, we get the same amount of good karma as they create. And when we rejoice when somebody who is kind of less advanced than we are, when we rejoice at their virtue and good qualities, then we get double the amount that they get. Okay? So for those of you who are into the investment market and merit, yeah, this is how to do it. Yeah, right. Spread it out, get a little bit of, you know, the inferior, the peer, and the superior, and, you know, then you won't go wrong with any of them, okay? So, what? Right. Yeah. actually like a really nice kind of meditation to do, and it's really nice to do when you're just sitting any old place, you know, or you're waiting in line, and so you just think about, you know, all the good qualities of the people in the line, who are in the line in front of you, and all the good qualities of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, whatever it is you're doing. If we train our mind to see other people's fortune and good quality and really be happy for them, then we're happy and they're happy. So it's a very, very important practice, this one. And you can see automatically that if we train our mind to rejoice in other people's happiness, we're going to have a lot more friends, aren't we? Because we're going to be a happy person. Somebody else has something good, we're going to rejoice, we're going to share in their happiness. People are going to think we're really swell, you know. But when somebody else has something really nice happen to them, and we go, that wasn't fair, and we're unenthusiastic, then even the friends we have now aren't going to want to be around us very much. So it's quite a nice thing. I think maybe this week, how about making your homework? Okay, you have four mental factors here. Yeah, actually there's homework on all four of them, because I think all of them are pretty ones that we can think deeply about. And so really, you know, this week, look at these four and see how they come up, and really look in your life. Make many examples of each one of them. You know, when do I get enraged? You know, what grudges do I have? You know, when am I spiteful in my words? When am I jealous? And so really notice the kinds of patterns we have in where we feel these different ones, and then very specifically practice the antidotes to them. Okay? So especially practice patience, and especially in this one, practice rejoicing. And really train our mind to be happy at others' well-being.
Mm-hmm. I think that in a way, patience, or not, I don't know exactly patience, that's also to do with faith.
Mm-hmm.
As a different idea of jealousy. That's the jealousy that we talked about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that you were saying, I'm just thinking specifically of the fear that you have when you're about to be jealous, like, where somebody's going to get more assignments that I'm going to get, or they're going to get more money that I'm going to get, or something like that. A lot of it comes from the fear that I'm not going to have, or something mm-hmm. like that. And that's where I think faith comes, because somehow the faith that I'm going to be okay.
That I can make do, I can handle it.
Yeah. That kind of mm-hmm. like, it's going to be okay, kind of cuts the edge off
yeah.
that craving or comparing mm-hmm. on all that, or like, I'm okay already. It's almost like, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
I also realized that I was picturing myself with that craving and that comparing with that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how, yeah. but they're kind of faith or qualifications.
Yeah. Faith and also contentment.
Uh-huh.
You know? What I have is good enough, and I can make it through, and this, you know, my situation is okay. You know what often I think is quite difficult for us is we've been brought up so much with this idea of fairness and what fairness means, that very often we get jealous when we think something isn't fair. Somebody else has it, but we don't. And, you know, I always thought that this was like a perfectly, you know, that this whole way that we think of fairness is really the way that things are, that they have to be. Until I lived in Asia and I realized that children growing up there, they never come to their parents and say, Mommy, Daddy, it isn't fair. My brother and sister got to do it and you won't let me. Yeah, I mean, this is what we do so much as kids, isn't it? It isn't fair, you know. Kid across the street gets to do it, how come I don't? You let my brother do it, how come I can? You know, we're always saying to our parents, it's not fair, it's not fair. Look at how we relate to the government. It's not fair, it's not fair. Even we have plenty, it's not fair. And so I'm beginning to see how our idea of fairness very often traps us into this kind of jealousy. in which we may actually be completely content. We may actually have everything that we want, but we think it isn't fair that somebody else has more than we do. Yeah? And so then we can't even enjoy what we have, but we want to make sure they don't have it. And it's quite something, because this idea of fairness, at least I realized in myself, it's very deeply ingrained there. It's very deeply ingrained. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's like, this isn't the value of every place in the world. I bet you do. Which means I don't like it.
I think that's what you say. Obviously, it's called the Sign of Love, it's called the Sign of Love. And one of the things is that they make it bicycle. And it's kind of funny that you talked about that today, too. And, you know, so many of those great ideals that he had, such a great man, but so much of it gets interpreted now as this isn't fair, that isn't fair.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are more like he talks about, he has such a terrible attitude. And they're so disrespectful to her, and because they have this feeling like it's just not fair, and I've never been treated fairly.
I mean, and even the people who have been treated fairly, or who aren't minority students, also think it's not fair. It's like, you know, we hardly ever feel that we're dealt justice.
I was reading an article that talks about a baby cries, leaving a bottle or leaving a bread or something, and you start feeling that things come from the outside. And I think that a lot of the times, even if you land, you start feeling that the sense of fairness doesn't have anything to do with your inner happiness, but it does have to do with a comparison with something outside of yourself. So if you started to feel fairness in relationship to how you feel and connected it to yourself, and try to create an inner sense of morality that doesn't depend on how much more or less that, rather than what you feel good with. That would be kind of a solution. I'm saying that to you, and it's really like anybody who's in a child is dealing with that issue, passing it along. Because I know, I mean, I happen to be at my two brothers, and inheritance kind of thing, where I have to say, I don't care what they get. I don't want to know it.
Yeah, right.
I don't want to know what they get. Don't even tell me. It's like, yeah. Because it's just, I don't want to compare myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I start comparing myself, then I'm going to start being picky about it. If I don't know, then I'm just going to be happy with whatever I get.
Mm-hmm.
And if I feel that, what is it good enough for me?
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing. We don't have it in society. We're like,
everything has to be divided exactly equal. Yeah.
In order to value yourself, you have to compare with something outside of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also what you said, how Martin Luther King's ideals have also often been corrupted into it's just not fair, when I don't think I mean, that really isn't what he was talking about.